This episode is brought to you by Windrose Recovery, a family of premier addiction treatment programs in southeastern Wisconsin. Privately owned, Windrose Recovery offers a full continuum of personalized care for those struggling with addiction, including the Manor for residential treatment, Midwest Detox for inpatient detoxification, and Windrose Counseling for outpatient treatment. With highly personalized treatment focused on trauma, Dr. Chantel Thomas and her expert team offer an authentic experience, creating the kind of deep emotional change that's crucial for long-term recovery. If you or someone you love is struggling with addiction, call Windrose Recovery at 414-409-5300. You can learn more about Windrose Recovery by clicking the link in the show notes or by visiting WindroseRecovery.com. Thank you for listening to The Path to Authenticity. My name's Tom Gentry. I think of this show as the opposite of small talk. You'll hear real conversations with real people who know who they are. We talk about what makes them who they are, how they became who they are, and how we might become truer expressions of who we are.
I'm Andy Isham, and this is The Path to Authenticity.
To Authenticity proudly supports the I Speak Media Foundation, advancing media literacy education through an evolving series of outreach programs within the communities that need it most. For more information, visit ispeakmedia.org. If this is your first time here, thanks for checking it out. If not, thanks for coming back. I'm Tom Gentry, and this is The Path to Authenticity, episode 96. So, for the 100th episode coming up here in a few weeks, I asked my friend and former guest, Heather Sundquist Hall, to create a work of art to commemorate that. So she did that. There's a link in the bio to find it. You can get it in a couple different sizes. Little 5x5 inch square that has the logo on it. Then you can get another one that's 9x12. It's pretty cool. I'm happy with it. Anyway, so coming right up on 100 episodes here. But if you haven't checked out the new website, please do that, thepathtoauthenticity.com. Please subscribe, leave a review if you're so inclined. Every little bit helps. So this episode is a conversation with a new friend of mine, Andy Isham, who lives in Madison, Wisconsin. We had a great conversation, which, man, I just really enjoyed. And the first time we spoke was a couple weeks before this, and it could have been another episode. I mean, I asked him to help me with some stuff. He's a friend of a friend, and we ended up chatting and just had a really good time, and he liked what I'm doing here at the podcast, and he seemed like a perfect fit, so He's an interesting guy, really smart guy, and we had a lot of fun. I hope you enjoy it. Andy Isham. It's Thursday the 5th, so we're a couple days into the 2020 presidential election extravaganza.
Yeah, there's that.
And I just watched the president's press conference where he came out and this whole poor Donald routine. So
yeah,
it's just it's been a pretty heavy week, you know.
Yeah,
but I also hopeful. I feel
boundaries hopeful around that when it comes to what I'm consuming, because I think there's I could get caught up in that wake, and it's not doing me any good. So I dip in and out, you know.
I've done pretty well with that for the most part, but I've indulged with this. I mean, it's the election, you know.
Yeah, so, if you're going to, now's the time.
Yeah, so, and I feel pretty good. I feel pretty good about where it's all going. So, anyway, but, so you and I caught up. We have a mutual friend, Dr. Thomas.
Yes.
And you've helped her some with her podcast, and so in turn helped me, because I'm trying to help her. And we got to talking and just had a really great conversation. And I guess, you know, I didn't really know what you did, and I assume you didn't know what I did. And as we ended up talking for like, what, 90 minutes on a Saturday night. And, you know, I just realized you'd be a great guest for the podcast. So, and I guess if one of the things I thought about before we started this conversation in terms of like a theme that we might touch on and might sort of relate a little bit to the subject matter of our last conversation, which we talked a lot about, you know, young people and having creative energy and that not always being supported by the people around us. And then what do we end up doing with all that? And I kind of told you my story with that, and you told me yours, but the pain of untapped potential.
Yes. That's a big theme.
Yeah. Yeah. So first of all, why don't you tell the listeners what you do day in and day out?
Okay. That varies tremendously depending on the day. But I think those parts that are kind of pertinent to the theme of your podcast would have to do with what all of those pieces add up to. So I do custom woodworking kind of in a unique way. I partner with an arborist here in Madison, Wisconsin, who occasionally has to take down trees. And when the owner, the client, is interested in having something built from that tree, oftentimes because they have a deep connection with the tree if they've lived in that place for a long time, I'll go in even prior to the tree being taken down and start to take a look at the materials they're in, and talk to them about what they'd like to have made. And then I mill up the wood, I kiln dry the wood, I do the designing and all of the woodworking, and bounce ideas back and forth with clients along the way. So there's not a rigid structure that I bring to what eventually becomes what I hope is, you know, the favorite piece of furniture that they have in any given room they might put it. It's kind of more like surfing. What you discover as you move through the stages of taking down the tree, processing the materials, discovering the unique grain therein, you're adjusting along the way. The way I like to go about this whole process is to kind of let the organic lines that are revealed tell me what it wants to be in terms of shape. So it ends up being, it's not all straight lines. Straight lines are in place when they're needed. A tabletop isn't going to work that well unless it's flat. But there's a lot of character and contour that can be a feature instead of a flaw, as it would be considered if you're using, say, commodity lumber. So that's a technical endeavor, a creative endeavor, and an artistic one in the sense that I have found my way into really digging in on the craftsmanship side. I've done woodworking in one way or another since I was little. But what really lit me up is when I could, at least I feel like I could start expressing a point of view in how I shape the materials.
The materials are the finished product.
Both? In a sense, they're one and the same, meaning the what I find with each new project is if I'm working with a walnut tree that's coming down, I am not working with, 100 board feet of walnut as you would go to a lumber yard and buy it. I'm working with, okay, where is the most interesting part in this tree? And let's start there. And let's feature that and let's allow that to kind of propagate throughout the processing of it, the design, and even, whether I'm using hand tools or using, power tools, whatever is more appropriate to surf that wave, that's what I pull out of my, my toolbox. Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
And so actually, it might be to expand on that initial question a little bit. Like you said, I also do, audio engineering. So I was trained as an engineer in college. And then I actually met our mutual friend, Chantel, while I was involved in research at the UW-Madison here. And that was actually behavioral health research. And the path from engineer to behavioral health that's another story. We can put that on the shelf. But so this technical background was always there. But I was also a musician throughout school and after I was done with college. I was always trying to balance deciding what I wanted to be when I grew up in a responsible way, as I was socialized to do, with that which I was curious about, that which lit me up, that which kind of that which I would play with in my mind as an insomniac. And I think ultimately a perspective that I have been able to, at least relative to myself, make great improvements on is the integration of those things and letting go of the idea that it is dichotomous. Are you a technically minded person? Are you an artistically minded person? Matter of fact, I would even say I always had trouble saying I'm an engineer. I have trouble saying I'm a woodworker or a musician because they feed into each other. I prefer I do engineering, which I still do as a consultant. So that's a part of the day, the kind of proverbial day we're talking about here. I'm doing that for, 6 hours of that day. And I'm also, designing and doing physical work, moving slabs of wood around. And using my ears to do the audio engineering stuff. So to me, the interesting thing is I have always had all of these curiosities since I can remember. And what I was presented with, at least, I own this as much as I put it on any social pressure, is that you have to pick one and you have to pursue it with the idea that if you maximize for what kind of value you can bring to our society in a certain realm, what you're fed from that realm doesn't need to be sufficiently broadly nutritious to keep you healthy because you can consume the rest with the currency you garner in the bucket you have chosen to keep yourself in henceforth. All of these things throughout any given day, by the time I'm ready to stop looking at data analysis, because it's no longer engaging, I'm toiling. Well, that's fine because then I can go out to the shop. And generally at that point, in the game of kind of, let's say motivational whack-a-mole, there's, then suddenly a wellspring of creative ideas because they've been they've been lying in wait and not active. And then, you know, throughout that kind of switching off, and that's a great freedom, but I have designed in the last 10 years that that's been by design, trying to find a place where, okay, well, I have all these different facets. They all need expression. And they then serve as the break from each other so that there's no need to recuperate from any of them, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it makes total sense to me. I don't know how much it makes sense to everybody else, but
yeah, I don't either.
Well, one of the things I've always kind of prided myself on is just being well-rounded and interested in a lot of different stuff.
Right.
And, you know, I had a conversation with somebody who I respect artistically not that long ago, who I was talking to her about this, you know, the podcast thing I write and, you know, there's all this stuff that I do. And she mentioned, you know, well, one of these days you decide on one thing, not from a contributing to society standpoint, but from a mastering your craft standpoint. And, but also like sometimes I make collages.
Yeah.
You know, and I, you know, I think I told you I was in the Carpenters Union when I was a young adult and there are parts of that that I really enjoyed. And I'd love to have a shop where I could build furniture and stuff like that. And do the type of stuff you're doing. I mean, but it does it all. It feeds all of it feeds my soul.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
And I don't want to let go of any part of it. And part of like me finding my authenticity, it's just been a matter of learning to trust myself instead of like an example I use is that I have a friend who has a podcast and it's been going for a few years and she's somebody I talked to as I was beginning to launch this. And she had a lot of suggestions of, well, you got to do this and you got to do that. And there were a lot of things that, okay, I don't want to have a call to action every 15 minutes. Like, I don't want to do that. You know,
that's not.
And I just decided, you know, I'm going to carry out my vision and I'll find my people. I don't need to like connect with everybody or I don't need to fit a mold. I want to do what I want to do. That's why I'm doing this.
Right.
Not because I want to like mass produce something, you know? I mean, so.
Oh man, I know what you mean.
Yeah.
That kind of transition, the initial seed, I always think of it as that, as in a way, something that I was more sensitive to as a child than, you know, the stages that followed, that interest, that curiosity, that sense of engagement or sensitivity. And then immediately following that, the pile on of, yeah, but this and that, you got to do it this way. You got to do it that way. You got to, here's a bunch of other things you don't want to do that are part and parcel with the spark of interest. And then what happens, it segues into something like toiling.
Something you don't want. Yeah.
Right. And thereby snuffing out that initial spark, which is I have to sharpen my chisels, which takes a long time and it's not the reason I got involved in this thing. but I look at it this way. Yes, part of the way that you handle that spark as an adult versus as a child is you don't just intellectualize everything. You keep the spark alive, but then you start to realize, okay, there is a price to pay. The chisel must be sharp. Right. But do you also have to, well, for me, for example, with the wood thing, if I'm drawing an accurate parallel with what you're saying is I was never, there's a lot of people who say, well, you have to be on Instagram, you know, every hour while you're in the shop.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And then you start, your attention starts to move to something that is entirely peripheral to that which gave you flow state to begin with.
Right.
And then the distraction spins out and you forget what you're doing in the first place. So there's that one tension on the side of like, how much of this is sharpening the chisel? How much of it is getting lost in comments? Well, okay, we can sharpen the chisel, but on the other side, there is changing the relationship to the process of sharpening the chisel. Mm-hmm. This image comes to mind from, I refer to these magical images from when I was young because I want to remember that sense of like just wild imagination and curiosity. And there's this video that used to be playing at the Gateway Arch in St. Louis. Have you ever been there?
I haven't.
Okay. It was built in the 60s, and the way they built it, they started stacking these giant stainless steel triangles on top of each other on the left side and the right side, which would be the south and the north side, it being a gateway to the west,
right,
symbolically. And they built it from each side up. So you're seeing right. The two sides of the arch come up, and then they're getting really close up top, and there's this kind of wonderful moment where they put the last piece in and then it's structurally stable. But before that, it was two like leaning towers, right, basically. Right. So that image comes to mind because I think of sharpening the chisel as you know, the side that's more difficult to address. You have that curiosity, you keep it alive, you be sensitive to it and don't let it get squashed out by what you're told about how things should and shouldn't be. Mm-hmm. But then as you move forward and you accumulate things that just are a part of the process of really exploring that curiosity, instead of just saying, well, I got to, you know, grin and bear it, you can also change your relationship to that sharpening of the chisel such that I'm going to be doing this for 3 hours tonight. I can be looking at the clock waiting for it to be done, or I can find fascination in it, right? Or at least attempt to. Mm-hmm. And there is beauty in even the smallest thing. That's what I believe. And I often can find, I can't always find it. But even if you're doing something mundane, if you can find kind of the meditative beauty in doing that, then both sides of the arch come together. And you're building something that's structurally sound in that kind of long, interesting exploration of moving from initial idea into a place where you're past just being competent, mm-hmm. and you're moving through proficiency and you're moving into expression.
Mm. That's funny. I can't think of a more complex analogy.
Yeah, see, that's the problem. I was thinking about this the other day.
I love it, by the way. I'm not, you know, it's a great analogy, but it is. This is huge. I mean, it's a big analogy, right?
I think in terms of, you know, there's some people, evidently, there are some people who think in words and others who think in textures or shapes. And mm-hmm. I'm in the latter category. So, right. The power of verbal communication, I think, is wonderful. But even from the get, even if I'm being as explicit as I can, that's already a level of kind of abstraction and metaphor to begin with. So then I tend to kind of diverge into metaphor on metaphor. Hope I don't.
Well, that's what makes you an engineer, right? I mean, that's part of an engineer's brain, isn't it? That abstraction quotient.
Yeah, I remember some testing around, okay, can you take a complicated three-dimensional shape, close your eyes and rotate it in any direction?
Right.
Just kind of how we're wired. It's the toolkit you're given. Of course, I'm sure you can develop in any direction, but that's my wiring. And so translating that into the verbal abstraction is something I've had to work on. Mm-hmm. Whereas I sit, the part of going back to the, what's a day like, So I spend the first hour or two of every morning before I get out. I wake up and I just lay with my eyes closed, usually for an hour or two. And that's when I do all the designing. I don't use a computer or paper and pencil. I just do everything. I move shapes around and try out different designs. When there's that kind of, that really open state, at least for me in my sleep patterns, that it's like as you're falling asleep, you're in that twilight place and you're making some kind of really obscure series of connections. And there's the subconscious is showing you things probably at that point. And there's an openness there that sometimes reveals, terror or what you need to work on, but also a sensitivity to a kind of inspiration that the practicality of moving through the day doesn't always, at least for me, give me access to.
Well, and, it's funny, you and I were talking about Jason Isbell the other night. We both like his stuff. I saw an interview with him, couple years ago with this guy Sam Jones, who has a talk show that he also does a podcast with. Anyway, he was talking about songwriting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And one of the things he talked about was doing it in the morning, getting started early, because the critic doesn't come out. You're still closer to a dreamlike state where you're tapped in to the creative side of your brain, and it's a lot easier to squelch that voice or, just work without being tethered by it until you're further along in the day. And I thought that was really interesting. It's similar to what you're talking about. And I've kind of tried to keep a rule of thumb for me, also being someone who does different things, many things. Generally speaking, I try to keep the beginning of my day open. There are certain times that, I'll just get a thought and I'll know there's a story there. And I won't necessarily know what it's gonna come out like, but I know it's there, mm-hmm. and I know where I want to arrive when I'm at the end of it, and I just have to see it through. It's not like the kind of thing where I'll make a note and do that later. No, mm-hmm. It doesn't work that way. 'Cause you gotta, like you were talking about riding the wave.
Yeah.
It's one of those things.
That is what I've been reckoning with probably more than anything. And I'm curious for you, because I've reckoned with this. You use the word squelch that voice, the critic, which mm-hmm. is, having listened to some of your other podcasts, I think we share the occasional vicious inner critic.
Yeah.
Is that true?
Well, and that's, yeah. I mean, I'm better at it. I've worked on it for a long time.
Yeah.
And actually, the first episode of this podcast is with an author, art therapist. Her name's Lucia Capicchione. And you've heard of inner child work.
Yep.
That's mm-hmm. Lucia's work. And she's written a whole bunch of books, and I was just fortunate enough to meet her like 20 years ago and get to know her a little bit, and I've stayed in touch with her. And so she was like the first, I've had her on the podcast like 5 different episodes.
Wow. Okay.
But inner child is the most widely used term as it relates to this stuff. She uses the term inner family.
Right. That's the parts work term is one that I'm familiar with.
Yeah. And, yeah. It's also ego states too. Mm-hmm. They're mm-hmm. in different different schools of psychology, they use different terminology, but it's all kind of the same thing,
yeah.
Which, you know, and she calls it the critical parent, what you're talking about. She calls it the critical parent. Then there's, you know, the, sometimes the inner brat or the inner teenager, you know, I mean, there, we have these different ego states, and if you don't know which one you're functioning from,
right.
But if you know the critical parent's talking, it's easier to disempower that voice.
Right. And so, and digging down on the disempower, here's my take. I'd love to hear yours. One thing that's helped me in the last, say, several years would be to make a gentle, conscious effort to not judge the judgmental voice, be that the brat or the parent.
Mm-hmm.
So there's it seems that there's something around holding everything kind of softly, like in a tactile way, like if you want to pick up a cup of coffee in like a cheap styrofoam cup. One of the reasons it's so difficult to do with a prosthetic hand is there's no feedback mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
You need to squeeze it enough to pick it up, but you need to, you'll crush it.
Yeah,
that actuator is going to want to crush it. And so when I have that, when I'm reckoning with that critical voice, I think I used to have a very adversarial relationship with it. And that's maybe like a younger person's thing, or at least a younger man in my experience, the kind of piss and vinegar energy, like, that's not what I'm doing right now, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And kind of beat it down, and that worked for a while. But at this point, I'm moving into where I'm closer to like giving it a hug and appreciating it, thanking it for its criticisms and allowing it to stay as long as it wants to, which if it's allowed to stay as long as it wants to, it's doesn't have much of an attention span. It moves on, you know, but rather than looking at my watch and waiting and for a different part to show up.
I think of a couple things with this. Mm-hmm. And one of them is, you know, just the idea that when you have a thought or whatever, the more attention you give it, the more power it has.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and also, like, if you attach a negative emotion to it, if it pisses you off, then you're fueling it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, in mindfulness practice, I mean, it talks about not judging it, just observing it.
Right.
And not judging it. And probably even more importantly, not attaching to it.
Right.
And letting it come and go.
Mm-hmm.
And not judging your thoughts I don't know about hugging it. For me, I mean, you know, I don't know. But it are,
pour
are
some you some tea and sit down with it.
Well, are you is it because you're also finding value in it?
I think in that moment, and there's not so I fortunately I rarely ever fully identify with it in that moment. So I can be mindful of the role that it's played, and I don't think I'm grateful in the moment for what it's doing, but I can be grateful for what it has done for me, because it's a legacy impulse that served a purpose, a survival purpose at a certain point. And I'm not even really implying it was, you know, critical to like a moving through a trauma even. It's just kind of the normal landscape of emotional existence involves a bunch of concepts that I am letting go of, like discipline. Mm-hmm. Discipline is a sprint, but there are other ways that are more sustainable to engage in behaviors that ultimately, looping back to the theme, reveal what seems to be a kind of never-ending stream of creativity and curiosity. Mm-hmm. But I don't conceptualize it in the way that, you know, if we could just get rid of all these things, then it would be, you know, I would identify as creative, curious being. They provide kind of some back pressure that, if handled well, will give more pop.
Well, yeah, maybe just that conflict.
Yeah.
There's energy in it.
You know? Mm-hmm. There's a contrast there. And so in the contrast is energy. And so I'm grateful for the – it's tricky. I mean, it's not that I get angry and judgmental and then say, oh, you know, thank you, implying that, you know, can I – thank you, sir, can I have some more? It's – I appreciate that there is no contrast without both. Mm-hmm. So it's a critical component of the reality of existence, as is the compassion, the creativity, the curiosity.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you mentioned the word discipline.
Yeah, I got a theory around that one.
Well, where I thought is, you know, one of the things I talk about on here is, and it, a lot of it's just a function of, this is where I am in my life, where I am mm-hmm. in my life, unlearning things.
Yes.
And, you know, discipline, I mean, it's, you know, by definition, following, you know, following it, disciple, you know. You're following a structured, made that connection. Yeah, you're following a structured thing. Like, you need to have the discipline to do this and do this and do that in order to big picture. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? If we didn't have this whole structure of indoctrination around what time you're supposed to go to work, what degree you're supposed to get, when you're supposed to get, you know, getting married, having kids, the whole thing. Mm-hmm. When if you just erased all that, what would you want to do? What would you do? If I erased all that, what time would I wake up in the morning? Mm-hmm. And what would I do with my thing? You know, I mean, that's the kind of thing that I've really tried to get to the essence of. What would I choose if I was making the rules? What now, would can I ask really you, work best for me? Yeah.
Do you see that as like an archaeological uncovering of something more fundamental to you or a tapping into something that's more fluid? So the answer would change if you were maximally sensitive and unlearned, continuously unlearning all of the doctrinal kind of rigid structures that, as you shed them, new ones come in to create a new carapace.
Well, I mean, to me, I think if you strip it all away, mm-hmm. the routine would be about survival when I have to eat. And the rest would all be curiosity.
Yes. Okay. I feel
so
that.
So it could change. You know, mm-hmm. it could be something completely different every day, but not feeling the external or internally imposed pressure to do anything at any given time, whatever, you know, I mean, just going with it and living.
Mm-hmm. That seems to be, to me, a state where if I've had glimpses of that state of awareness that you're describing, interestingly, what emerges from that as an adult is I am not inclined to just consume or seek comfort. I'm inclined to do things that actually are contributions to society. So it's not as though I would wither away,
right,
you know, in a castle if I was given everything. Although I think it would be a burden if there were no constraints around in a way. But that curiosity itself, and I'm trying to identify primary colors here. And I think, you know, when you move from the idea, there's a trope that, you know, if only I wasn't expected the parental expectations, the societal expectations, blah, 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 then I could see the thing I'm supposed to do, which oftentimes people fill in that blank with something that's not a primary color. It's too specific. It's more of a, it's a symbol that represents a deeper freedom. And I don't know if curiosity is the fundamental thing there, but what stems from curiosity? When you're a child,
action,
investigation, engagement.
Right.
And so the kind of the parallel to me of what a non-traumatized, and free in terms of expectations child does, they move their body. They're healthy. Mm-hmm. They want to wear a bunch of different hats. You know what I mean? They enjoy,
mm-hmm.
and they don't want to, they don't want to go to bed. They want to do more.
Yeah.
They want to investigate more. And that investigation unreels new paths. And all of those paths are potentially places where what they end up doing in terms of brass tacks, those actions are contributions. So this dichotomy around, well, you know, you got to be practical versus
right.
your head in the clouds kind of thing. I think it's a false dichotomy. At least that's my conceptualization of it when I feel like I'm in that free space that you were describing. Mm-hmm. That the naturally emergent quality of a free person is to give, to contribute, to create, and to exercise all of the more compassionate angels of their nature, not the consumptive ones.
Well, and you know, I'm at the risk of sounding like a full-fledged socialist or something. Yeah. I mean, I think part of this, a significant part of this, is how we're indoctrinated, and in terms of what we're supposed to do to contribute to society, and who does that benefit? You know, I mean, I think think about how many of us spend our lives enriching someone else as we just merely survive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, trying to get that job with the good health insurance, waiting for that raise. I mean, you know, we're not living for ourselves. You know, and not if we're doing that. And, you know, I think the bargain as a society that we've made is, well, the trade-off is we get to have family, and that's where we draw our meaning. But for me, like, I mean, don't get me, I love my family, you know, but I need to get meaning from what I'm doing with my time and how I make my money.
Right.
If it doesn't matter to me, I don't really want to do it, you know?
And what would you be modeling? There's this interesting, I don't know if it's, it can't be exclusively Midwestern, but it's certainly that, at least the idea that we sacrifice, and this, I'm speaking from the perspective of somebody who does not have kids. So take this for what it's worth. But you sacrifice in order to provide for your kids so they have all these opportunities to do exactly what I'm not sure beyond, I don't know, financially supersede you perhaps, but right. But in the process of that, what you're modeling is I'm toiling so that you presumably one day don't have to toil, but the only model that you've seen, which is much more powerful than the right. concepts right. presented around the model, are that toiling to. Now, I am all on board with the idea of sacrifice, but when that's what's shown to you, it seems like, oh, well, I'm miserable, but so you won't have to be one day. But now you've just learned that the currency is misery, and so it propagates through the generations. We'll see how that pans out if I have kids.
Here's just to give you some of my perspective, and I have a 14-year-old son. Mm-hmm. And I've had a career where I've traveled some, and, you know, I could have made more money if I traveled more. And, you know, I mean, and, you know, it's in substance abuse treatment, and I've worked with a lot of young men from affluent families who had no relationships with their dads.
Oh.
Because they were off making money to provide a great life for them. And all they ever wanted was to be with their dad. And, you know, by the time they get to me, I mean, they're not on a winning streak, you know? I mean, they've been in addiction treatment, you know, they've probably been arrested, or, you know, their lives are literally falling apart. They're killing themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And when you talk to them and you get to those wounds, I mean, almost invariably the young men, there's always a dad wound. And I think all of us have some kind of dad wound, father mm-hmm. wound. But, I was thinking about this a little bit ago, just, you know, this being in a childlike. One of my favorite moments of my son's life that I will never forget is he was probably 3 and he's sitting on the couch and he's just being a happy kid, you know, and he pats the seat next to him and looks at me and says, come on, be with me, be with me. That's, you know, that's all kids want. And so when it came time for me, like there've been a few times in my career where I've made a conscious decision to take the job that affords me more time with him over money, over bells and whistles, whatever, always more time with him. And, you know, and he probably didn't always appreciate it, but I never doubted that it was the right thing to do. I mean, there were sacrifices that came along with it. So back to the sacrifice thing, if I'm going to sacrifice anything, it's going to be in the interest of loving him, being there for him.
Did you have that, that impulse right from the jump?
Well, you know, things are more nuanced than that, you know, because for me, I mean, when there was a moment when there was like a dramatic version of that decision when it came up for the first time, and it was, I was going through a divorce at the time and figuring out custody and all that stuff, and which I always wanted as much time with him as I could possibly get. But then in the midst of all that, there came this job opportunity in Nashville. Mm-hmm. And I'm in West Palm Beach. And so, moving wasn't going to be an option. And I made that clear. And, but, you know, they wanted to talk about, well, what else maybe can we work out, which would have involved commuting somewhat regularly, traveling a lot, you know, and also if I was to take it with the intention of eventually moving there within the next 2 or 3 years. And I just, so I entertained it because it was, it would have been, it was flattering. You know, and it was, I was honored that they, it was an honor. So I went through the process, but, you know, got to the point where, you know, after the first couple stages of the interview process, you know, that it was, I had to make a decision and, you know, they told me, you know, take as much time as you need and let us know, if you want to move forward with the next stage of this. And I sat on it for about a week and I called the CEO of this company and said, you know, I'm just this, I'm not going to leave my son. I'm not going to do it. You know, I mean, and it was the kind of company that I probably couldn't have made a better move, you know, because they were that kind of company.
Right.
But also like, that's just that side of it. I mean, you know, I also, I felt like not in a overt way, but I let my son know that, you know, I choose him. He knows that. I mean, there have been times when we've had these conversations where, listen, we could have more. We could, you know, we could have this and we could have that, but I've always chosen you over stuff.
And was there a moment that you can recall where, I mean, it's understandable, I'm sure, by anybody that you would be on that fence. Was there something that tipped you definitively in the direction that you went?
Yeah, you know, I mean, probably more because I was going through a divorce at the same time and there were custody implications. And, you know, I remember talking to a buddy of mine who, great guy. Also, he went through the same stuff like a year before. It had a son around the same age, had just gotten divorced, you know, figuring out life all over again with in a way that you didn't plan, you know? Mm-hmm. And I remember talking to him about, you know, I got this stuff going on too with the job thing and, you know, what do you think? And he was like, dude, are you kidding? I mean, you take your son, like your son, there will always be another job. Like, you know, and it was what I needed to hear at the time. And, but that's because, you know, I have learned over the years that I need good men in my life. I need men to go to. And I've always, especially when it comes to dad stuff, you know, I've always had, there are certain guys who I go to talk about stuff. And they're guys who I admire and who I know beyond the shadow of a doubt are great dads.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I mean, it's like, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure you do that with professional stuff, right? You have your go-to guys that you talk to about stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. And the most important thing, you know, apropos of the podcast name, the most important thing there is that I trust. I don't follow the letter because we all have, of the advice, because we all have underlying values that only we can be sensitive to. But to get an authentic response is sadly rare, but I feel blessed that I do have those people. Mm-hmm. And as time continues to erode the, you know, the interpersonal landscape, those are the rocks that remain uneroded.
Well, and you know, it's funny because I mean, you know, a lot of people will just talk shit. You know, I mean, like everybody's got an opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, especially when it comes to relationships and stuff like that, I think. And I've just learned over the last few years, you know, I'm very careful about who I go to for any kind of advice or input. You know, I mean, sometimes if I just need a sounding board, somebody to listen, that's different. But when I'm looking for insight or direction, I'm at a place in my life where I'm either going to trust myself or pay somebody to give me advice who's a professional or someone who's like really deep in the inner circle, you know, and I respect a whole lot. But you know, like I just remember having this conversation with the guy about this thing with the girl, you know, and it hit me like at one point, like, why am I listening to this guy? Like
I've been there.
He's, you know, he's miserable. Yep. He's you know, been married and divorced several times. I mean, why am I talking to this guy about this? Why am I? And, you know, I guess the simple answer was because I didn't trust myself. And mm-hmm. that's when I let go of that, you know?
And if you sense, sorry, go ahead.
No, well, and I knew what I wanted to do. And sometimes like I had, there was, you know, I was going to do what I was going to do anyway, that too. And then, but I remember, you know, a clear example of one of those conversations with someone who I do trust when I was ready for the input that I probably already knew what it was,
yeah,
but just needed support. It was over a relationship that I needed to end. And it was my go-to guy. I had him, we met for coffee and, you know, I'm just kind of telling him what's going on. And I just said, so what do you think? And he looked at me and he said, you really want to know? And I said, I do. And he said, okay, you asked. And he cut loose. You know, and he shot completely straight with me, like, you know, which basically was, it may be good some of the time, but what I see between you two people is it will never be great.
Mm.
And you're my friend. I love you. You deserve great. I want to see you happy. You deserve more. But I wasn't going to go to him with that to get that until I was ready to do what I needed to be done, you know?
Right.
I waited. We're weird, you know? I mean, aren't we like, I don't know. Maybe it's.
Oh, I really can pivot off of what you said about I get a sense of for better and frankly, sometimes for worse, whether we're conscious of it or not, sometimes we need to ask permission to do what we already know we're going to do.
Right.
And if I'm operating from a place of bitterness, I want permission to do something that's not constructive. I also have people who I know through the kind of parallel conversation, the one you just described, will give me permission to do the bitter thing.
Mm.
So
yeah, I usually have people to say, okay, you know, don't do that. That's not going to get you anywhere.
I mean, right.
But yeah, no, I mean, this is, you and I go deep real fast, man. We're having this conversation. I'm like, I'm wondering if anybody can follow this or if it's just us. Cause I mean, especially when we got to the St. Louis Arch thing.
Yeah. Did I go too far there?
No. But you know,
I got more.
I mean, one thing I want to mention to you is we're doing this and, you know, you're obviously a guy who's pretty deep and you seem like pretty emotionally grounded and literate. Was that fair assessment?
I wouldn't consider myself objective enough to assess it, but I'll go with it.
Okay. Well, I mean, is it something you at least aspire to? It's not something you're opposed to being emotionally
literate. It's something
literate.
I give attention and energy to regularly. Yeah.
Okay. So one of the things I've done with this podcast, because I'm really interested in men's work too, I haven't done one in a couple months, but I do a segment called Getting Real About Manhood.
Ooh, I like it.
Yeah. And I have a buddy out in Denver, his name's Ed Tilton, and we do it together, and it's a little bit shorter episode. And usually there's a theme. Mm-hmm. The first one was just kind of setting it up. We did one on male privilege.
Mm.
The last one we did was about men and abuse and how men respond to abuse, how society deals with that or doesn't. Yeah. And just, you know, like it talked about some things like, especially around with guys who have been sexually abused by a woman, like say mm-hmm. as a teenager. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, a lot of people, you tell them that story about the hot teacher who slept with the teenage kid. I mean, they're going to be like, boohoo, dude.
That's yeah,
everybody's dream. But at the end of the day, he's traumatized because it's yeah. not right. That's not, you know. And so there's a lot of that kind of stuff. But anyway, so what do you feel like as men that we need to do better with?
Okay. I think there could be quite a list there. the first thing that pops to my mind, I think something that is timely is acknowledging, I can only speak from my own perspective. I don't want to over caveat, but acknowledging that a part of my male experience has to do with aggression. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that's coming from a place of small t trauma or not. It feels innate. Mm-hmm. So, and I see the manifestation of that kind of aggression. The algorithmic amoral backbone of online mm-hmm. seems to amplify it quite yeah. a bit. Yeah. And so it's right in your face because we're all there all the time. But
well, there's a curtain to hide behind too.
Yeah. Which allows you to let that manifest with no consequence essentially. But for me, one of the parts of, and I do feel there's a spectrum. We're not all, you know, built the same, and there's a spectrum, and a big part of my male or masculine identity has to do with how I process that competitiveness and aggression, in a way that is productive rather than destructive. And I mean, it's funny that I thought about, so obviously back to the woodworking thing, I have a log yard and I have fireplaces and I split wood.
Mm-hmm.
And it occurred to me when I came in indoors last winter after an hour of splitting wood and just taking stock of where I was in terms of my, was I judgmental? Was I a good listener? Did I have decent impulses? And all of these knobs that I would prefer to have some sense of agency over that stem from aggression, I notice they're lower. So I need an outlet. I need an outlet for that energy, which may be considered less civil or mature or whatever you want to call it. You can put it in a bucket and say we should intellectualize it and wish it away. But for me, I am a much better person to deal with if I have a place to go with that aggression, whether it's splitting wood or whatever my thing is. But when I'm splitting that wood, I'm hammering on my body. Mm-hmm. And when I'm done, that has been processed, whatever that is. And that part of whatever, you know, warrior spirit I've got within me has been given a seat. It's been acknowledged. It's been exercised. And then the other pieces are allowed to shine. And there seems to be, and I'm not in a position to make broad sociological observations. It's not my area of expertise, but
I'll do it for you in a minute.
Okay. So from my perspective, anecdotally, there is overemphasis in the cerebral, and what happens from the masculine side is that aggression is considered to be something that you should be too evolved to have to reckon with.
Right.
But personally, if I have an outlet for it, then the other ways in which I can evolve are free to do so. Instead of quietly in the background, this energy, which is beautiful energy if it's channeled correct. Right. And it's not all, you know, it's not always correctly channeled for me. It lives within me hugely every day, and I need to go somewhere with it. And then the masculine becomes something that's complementary to not just broader society, but the feminine. Mm-hmm. And I have feminine in me as well, and that's allowed to manifest.
Well, and you know, these aren't, I think one of the problems with all this stuff and how we talk about this stuff in society, is it's nuanced and there's a lot to it. And when we're covering that stuff in this conversation, it's mm-hmm. not just as simple as he's aggressive, he's toxically masculine. It's there's, that aggression, I believe, is innate and
I do too.
And is valuable if it's channeled the right way. If it's channeled. And, mm-hmm. you know, the way there's an author named John Eldridge who's written about men. One of the expressions he uses is that we need a battle to fight.
Yes.
We need exactly. a battle because we are warriors. We deep down, it's in our DNA.
Yeah,
we need a battle to fight. And this is something I've been thinking about the last couple of days, you know, with the election, because, you know, I was really, really hoping, you know, aside from, you know, real political beliefs, like conservative or liberal, aside from all that, Donald Trump's a fucking asshole. He treats yeah. people like garbage. He's not a good man. He's not a good man, but he is also to some like emblematic of what manhood is supposed to be, but he's really unhealthy. And so I woke up November 4th, just like, I can't believe 65 million people voted for him after what he's done. It saddened me so much. And just processing that over the last couple days, here's what I think he has done successfully. He has helped people find a sense of belonging where they didn't have it. And he gave a bunch of guys a battle to fight.
Yes, I agree.
And you know what? The other side isn't doing that. And I think because we're the way we are culturally, you know, we're not emotionally grounded. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, you're talking about having a feminine side. Like most guys would be like, what are you talking about? You know, I mean, guys don't want to hear that shit for the most part. I think this is, it's a lot deeper than just politics.
Oh, when I back up and look at the situation, I think a repressed masculinity becomes toxic, too broad a term. Abusive. Yeah. And so a totem, like Trump, who is, from my perspective, a traumatized kind of bucketed swamp of masculinity.
Yeah. I mean,
that's a place where, were I to say align myself, fortunately for me, I don't tend to pick a team. So I don't look for any given subculture to give me the permission to express everything. Mm. That needs to be processed. But if I did, and I look at him, all of those, what were initially warrior tendencies that are not given voice, then they're not allowed to converse. Well, then they're going to howl.
Yeah.
And that howl has manifested in,
it's going to hurt, you know, people.
Yeah. And so that's, you know, our shadow, our collective shadow is being squeezed out in the form of who we've chosen here.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and you know, think about just listening to him talk and the things that he says, it's aggression.
Yeah.
And it's you have, I mean, I've witnessed like people cheering him on for being a jerk. Like, think about that.
That's wild.
It happens all the time. Same with the press secretary when she talks down to people in the media. Like, you know, people are giving each other high fives over that. I mean, you know, and to me, it's got to be on some level like freeing for someone who has this repressed aggression and doesn't know what to do with it, to see someone letting it out and, you know, they experience a little bit of it secondhand, like satisfaction.
Right.
And I guess like my thing with politics that, you know, we need someone who's in touch with all this stuff, who understands all this stuff to be a leader.
Yeah. I mean, that again, not my area of expertise, but it seems to me that, at least currently the systems don't incentivize somebody who is in touch.
Well, they make fun of them. That's what they do. I mean, that's what they did to Marianne Williamson.
Right.
Who is a wise owl, man. I mean, she gets it.
I agree.
Yeah.
I think she's incredibly impressive in her authenticity. Yeah. The problem is, for whatever reason, authenticity is not rewarded unless it's a repressed geyser of that, those kinds of impulses that are in, they're ostensibly authentic. I mean, I think Trump is an authentic agent in that his response is
he's hurt and he's responding like someone who's hurt.
Right. And validation, constant seeking of it via whatever works is enough to just continue it for a lifetime, evidently stave off that hurt.
Yeah.
I mean, there's time left. You never know. But, I mean, my money's on it's going to stay that way.
Yeah.
I don't even want to villainize anybody because what comes to the surface seems to be just a result of what we collectively are repressing. So that is a tango. That is involving both the pursuer and the pursued.
Yeah. Well, and there's so much to all this stuff. Like, I mean, think about the lengths that politicians go to not acknowledge that they made a mistake.
And that is, so my MO is do the experiment. Don't tell me what's going to work. Tell me what your experimental approach is. When you're learning anything, you know, I burned 10 tables before I made a good table because I had a great big mound, like a pile of coal. Each little nugget of coal is a mistake. Right. And I've got to – let's celebrate that we did the experiment, made the mistake. Now we know more.
Yeah, but through. Also, like, I'm not perfect. We don't have to be perfect. I mean, it's so fake. It is. It is. I mean, and a lot of times, like, we watch these debates, I mean – a lot of times the reason they don't answer questions is because they know it's going to turn into a soundbite and somebody's going to take half of what they said, just like, you know, Biden's going to raise taxes, but they cut out the part where it's for anyone who makes over $400,000 a year. You know, I mean, it's which speaks to inauthenticity. I mean, there's
right.
Yeah. Anyway, I didn't mean to go into a total political rabbit hole, but it does tie into what, you know, the masculinity stuff, the and the aggression. Like, I agree with you. And that's I forget about that part of it a lot of times that, you know, we need to acknowledge that that exists and do something with it or else it will come out in ways that it shouldn't.
Right. And that sensitivity, that baseline of sensitivity, if it's not there for someone, fine. But if it is, whatever stillness is required to recognize that within yourself, I feel like my relationship to social change, in a way, the agency I have has more to do with seeking that first on an individual level and then in conversations like this, so that if you tell me I have been quiet enough to be sensitive to kind of the fundamental colors that come up within me that need to be processed and aggression's not a big part of it, that's fine. But whatever your set, whatever your box of crayons looks like, I don't care what it looks like. But you just have to give voice to all of those colors in one way or another, or they're going to start giving voice to you.
Hmm. All right. So if there was a time in your life when you would go back to the younger version of yourself, the younger Andy, and offer him, maybe he's struggling, offer him a bit of advice or support, when was that, and what would you say to him?
Boy, that's a big question. So because my experience of growth in my life has not been about, there have been explosive new constraints put on me in moments, but the actual expansion is slow and steady, like a tomato plant. I would say there's not a moment in time, but let's say when I came online from the age of 13 to 27, something like that, when what I was transitioning into was, okay, I'm moving into adulthood and I have the conception that I'm looking at a menu and I have to select something off of that menu. And I held that as the truth of my reality for a long time. And what I would say to that 13 to 27 year old is, I know it doesn't feel like this, but you don't have to select from that menu. There's a false dichotomy or multichotomy involved here. You're being told that you're committing to who you are, and you have the idea that you're selecting an identity. You don't have to do that. Instead you can learn to cook. You can make your own.
Dinner. Right.
And
you should. You should.
Furthermore, you should. I think maybe, yeah, there's probably a universal element to this, in that if you end up cooking something that's identical to one of the items on the menu, so be it. But get there via the exploration, not via the I'm signing up to be this person and I'll take everything that's part and parcel to that person. Now here's the kicker though. If you make me that time machine and you give me that option, I'd have to think about whether or not I'd want to go back and talk to that guy.
I figured you're going to say that, because you needed to experience what you've experienced to get to where you are now.
Right. And there's a great relief in letting go emotionally of this kind of regret concept. Mm. And of course you can do things that are hurtful. You can be cruel to yourself or to other people, but if that was the path, and it took the, you know, estimation 14 years or whatever it was of spending that time in that false multichotomy, I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful for having not had the 41-year-old Andy show up to the 13-year-old and set him straight. First off, the 13-year-old would have said, go to hell. What are you talking about?
Yeah.
But even if I had internalized it at that point, I'm not sure it would have meant as much. I'm not sure that it would have been...
You wouldn't have been ready to hear it.
Yeah, there you go. Mm-hmm. So I love the thought experiment. I'm also grateful for having whatever insights I've had when I've had them, not prior.
Well, this has been great.
Oh, yeah. Been a pleasure, man.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, we got to figure out what happens next, because this is too good. We got to, you know, I don't know if it's another episode or something. It just feels like we need to continue this dialogue.
Oh, I'm game anytime. I think you could take a 5-minute sample from any part of this, and we could do an hour on that. So.
probably.
Well, this is fun. Whatever you want.
Thanks for listening to The Path to Authenticity. If you'd like to learn more about our guest, you can find links in the show notes or visit our website at thepathtoauthenticity.com. If you're interested in becoming a sponsor, if you have a suggestion for a topic, or you know someone who would make a great guest, email the show at thepathtoauthenticity@gmail.com. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts. If you know someone else who would enjoy the show, or even just a particular episode, please share it with them. Every little bit helps. If you're not already a subscriber, please consider becoming one wherever it is you choose to listen. You can find the show on Patreon, where by becoming a patron, you can hear episodes before they're released publicly. You can gain access to supplemental content. There are other benefits in the various tiers. Visit patreon.com/thepathtoauthenticity. Join our Facebook community or follow the show on Instagram, both at The Path to Authenticity. We also have a YouTube channel. You can connect with us on Twitter or Pinterest. To hear the songs from this and every episode, you can find the Path to Authenticity playlist on Spotify. Obviously, there are a lot of ways you could be spending your time, so I appreciate you spending some of it here with me. I'm Tom Gentry. Thanks for listening. Be nice. Path to Authenticity is powered by Equivox. For digital marketing and web design services, visit Equivox.com.